Hello, family. My name is Linda, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me in the back? All right. Thank you for the warm welcome. I feel right at home. A lot of love in these rooms, and the love is so healing. What it was like, what happened, and how I got here, what it's like today. I come from a really loving, wonderful home that was not filled with alcoholics. But I was an alcoholic before I picked up the first drink. And I'd like to tell you a little story from when I was 7. I went to Catholic school, and my mother's name was Mary. And for Mother's Day 1 year, and my father's name was Joseph. Okay. And for Mother's Day 1 year, they were offering a statue of Mary with a rosary in the bottom, a screw-out bottom. And I had to have it. Of course, I wasn't going to ask anybody if I could have the money because we really couldn't afford it. So I decided to take the money. And I went in my mother's wallet, and I took money out. And I was so excited because I was buying the statue, and I bought the statue. So my mother said she was very perplexed. And earlier that day, she was going to go food shopping, and she went looking for the money for the food, which was gone, and I helped her look for it. And, you know, so now I pop it with this statue, and she's not supposed to put two and two together. But I got in a lot of trouble. But I share that story because the goal was something good, the methods and the thinking were slightly twisted. And this is before alcohol. So this is how I lived. I every kind of felt like an alien. And I remember hearing about this woman called Rockefeller, and I remember asking my dad if they had made a mistake in the hospital, because I was sure that I was supposed to be with that family. Because that family had money. And we didn't have money. We weren't poor, but, you know, we didn't have money. So again, I didn't feel like I felt, and I'm the oldest of 4 children, a lot of responsibility. And everything was really pretty nice until I was 12. And at the age of 12, my mom had been diagnosed with breast cancer the year before, a couple years before, and she's very, very sick, and she died. And she was 33. And she left 4 young children, and I was very angry at God. I could not understand why God took this young mother of 4 children and left murderers and rapists on the street. So I had no more to do with him. This is kind of hard when you go to Catholic school, right? I worked really hard at that. And I went through emotions, you know, I said the prayers, I went through confession, I took communion, but I was not connected to anything. So if you're not connected to God and you're very smart, which I was, you now become the power in your life. Well, my father wasn't the power because I was angry at him too, because shortly after my mother died, he remarried. I was very angry at him. So I am this ball of anger. And, at the age of 15, I got pregnant. And I was in Catholic school, an all-girl Catholic school, and they don't like to have little pregnant girls. In all-girl Catholic schools, and they asked me to leave. And, you know, this is a very, very hard time. This is at a time when, my son is 40 now, so it wasn't acceptable like it is today. And I was sent to a home for unwed mothers, and I had to put my son in foster care. I was very angry, and I was ashamed, and a lot of other feelings. I just remember all of these feelings. I was also molested by a family member. So all of this happened in those formative years. And I'm not talking to anybody about this stuff, and I'm full of shame, and I'm full of grief, and I still haven't had a drink yet. So I came back from the home after I had the baby, and I went to public school, and I did not fit in public school. And I remember seeing the kids stop by the deli in the morning, and by beer, I thought this was crazy. First of all, they were too young, and it was 8 o'clock in the morning. But my thinking changed. You know, in AA we have this big sign that's upside down. It's upside down and backwards. And it's like that for a reason. So a few weeks later, I stopped at that very same deli and I bought a can of Coke 45. And I drank that can of Coke 45. Oh. It did something for me. All of a sudden, I fit in. One can. So I drank the can, and, you know, I got a little dizzy, and I got to school late, and I weaved my way down the hall, and I ran into the assistant principal, and he said, "Why aren't you in class?" I said, "Why don't you mind your business?" I had a very nasty attitude. Very nasty. And I was unafraid of power figures. It didn't matter who you are. I wasn't listening to you. Rules did not apply to Linda. They were for stupid people. That's how I thought of it. I already knew what to do, and I didn't need your rule. And this is how I approached everything. I did exactly what I wanted, exactly when I wanted to do it. It didn't matter how you punished me. And my poor father and my stepmother caught her. They just caught her. I graduated on time, by the grace of God. I did not go to school till maybe 3 weeks before the end of school, and I would pass all my classes with an 85. So that told me I was smarter than the teachers, and I didn't need to go like everybody else needed to go. I had hippie parties at my house, and then lied and told my father that someone broke in and messed everything up. It was very chaotic. And so I tell you, my son was in foster care, and I worked very hard while in high school. I got a part-time job. I saved every penny, and 6 months after I graduated, I got my son out of foster care. I had my own apartment, a car. My son had his own room. I had furniture. Let me tell you about furniture. My first furniture that I built for my apartment was a bar and 2 bath stools. That just said that I had arrived. You know, I had a little ramp on the drive, a shed bar, in case you weren't sure. And I stocked the bar with mine, because that's what I drank in those days. And my house was kind of a party house, because I was the first one of my friends to have their own apartment. And I was grown, so I thought. So, you know, I'm working very hard. My first job was in a bank, and I'm working and taking my son to daycare, and, you know. And on Fridays and Saturdays, we drank. And I started blacking out then, but I don't know that then. This is looking back in hindsight. Because I would have people at my house, and I would know that they were at my house maybe for the first half an hour. After that, I couldn't tell you who was there, what they were doing. So the drinking progressed. I used to work and then come home, and before I could check homework or cook or talk to anyone, I had to have a drink. Now, if you spoke to me before I had that drink, you quit all my agitation from the day. Here's what made me agitated. You people. All people. If the bus wasn't at the bus stop when I came out the door, it wasn't pulling up when I got there, I got agitated. If you were walking in front of me and you didn't move fast enough, I got agitated. If you were my boss and you came and actually gave me some work to do while I was at my desk, I got agitated. Everything bothered me. So at the end of the day, I would be like this. And I often felt like a pressure cooker waiting to explode. But once I came in and had that drink, I was wonderful. I would do the homework and cook dinner, and I didn't get drunk in those days. You know, right? I just needed to take the answer. But, you know, it's a progressive disease, and it just doesn't stay in this nice, neat little package. And I remember thinking when I drank, I never wanted to get drunk. That was never my goal. My goal was a place called Mellow. Mellow is elusive. Sometimes you can get there, and sometimes you can't. And I didn't like getting sloppy drunk, but sloppy drunk happened. So I'm drinking, and I got checked out of the secretarial pool and put into a management training program very young, and my career took off. I started going to college at night. I became the president of the PTO at my son's school, and I'm this young up-and-coming executive, and I drank. And then it got to be a little too long to wait until I got home from work. And I found out that she could go to a bar after work and drink for like 2 hours. And the ladies drink 2 for 1. And so I would drink for 2 hours and then go home. And I would drive home from Manhattan to Queens, which is about half hour, 40 minutes. I would do it in about 12 minutes. Now, the only way you could drive from Manhattan to Queens in 12 minutes is if you don't stop the red light, stop signs, or pedestrians. So my thought was, get out the way, I'm coming. And I only took credit because I never had an accident and I never had a DWI. Never. I took credit for that. So when I was hanging out with other people and we were all drinking together, they gave me the keys. I couldn't see half the time, you know. There were like 12 lights coming in this direction because I was on the wrong side of the road and I blamed all the other people. And that's what I did. That's how I drove. I drove 80 miles an hour all the time and I didn't pay attention to street signs or lights or anything. And this was not a problem. I prided myself on my career progressing. I think by the time I was 26, I made more money than my father, so, you know, you couldn't pass me. Arrogance? I thought it was a compliment, you know. But I can tell you that I was in grief. I had not grieved the death of my mother because some things happened in the home and that was just kind of shut down. All her personal belongings kind of disappeared one day and we weren't allowed to talk about her because my father said it made him sad. And but I never believed it. So I was in pain from that. I was in pain from the molestations. I was just in pain. And I remember asking my dad one day, I said, you know, I think there's something the matter with me. Do you think I should get help? And I wasn't talking about the drinking. I was just talking about how I felt. And he said, there's nothing wrong with any of my children. Just use your willpower. Just do the right thing. So that's the plan. And I thought, I didn't get any help, and the drinking progressed. And now I went to a movie, and I don't remember what movie it was, but the person in the movie went out at lunchtime, and they had a martini. Ooh, this looks interesting. So I said, well, if one martini is good, two has got to be better. And I went out for lunch, and I had two martinis. To this day, I couldn't tell you what happened. I never went back to work that day. I don't know what happened. Another blackout. And blackouts were happening more frequently. I would go out, so here's how I went out. I would start in the afternoon drinking. I would turn my music up really loud, because I like to dance. And I would tune up. I called it tuning up at home. So I'm drinking and tuning up. And here's this poor kid, my son. This poor baby. He lived in a crazy household with two mothers. One was like the 9-to-5 mommy who cooked and went to work and cooked dinner and went to PTA meetings and all of that. And then there was the other mommy. And I remember one time his friends were outside playing right outside the window and you could hear a couple of the boys' mothers calling them down the block. And they said, you know, David, we never hear your mother yell. He says, my mother doesn't yell. My mother speaks very quietly. And when she speaks, you better be listening. They were terrified. But I didn't have any trouble with my son. I recognized today that it may not have been a good thing. He was frightened of me because he never knew he was going to show up. So to speed things up a little bit, you know, I prided myself on having excellent credit. I paid, I paid bills ahead of time. I had good credit. I went to work. I wasn't having trouble getting to work yet. But it was coming. I was starting to go to work on Mondays with a really bad head. I mean, really breathing hurt. The hangovers were becoming horrendous. Oh, and I was talking about blackouts. So I was talking about tuning up on a Saturday to go out, and I'm drinking maybe starting about 6 o'clock. I had a physical allergy to alcohol from the very beginning because whatever I drank, however I drank it, cold or hot, light or dark, top shelf, bottom shelf, beer, wine, it didn't matter. At some point in the evening, I was going to puke my guts up. and it didn't matter. Now, if you gave me anything else to eat, like a potato, and it made me throw up, you couldn't pay me to eat another potato. But not so with alcohol. You know, I drank, and it made my head hurt, and I didn't like how I felt, but I liked how I felt when I drank. And I needed it, and I didn't know that I needed it. I just knew that if I didn't have it, I couldn't cope. That's what I thought. So things started to get a little crazy with the job. I started not being able to work 5 days a week. 5 whole days was a bit much. I didn't use, you know, at 1 o'clock I would come up with some drama that someone had died or some pipe had burst or something. Because I just couldn't take it anymore and I would just leave. And then I wouldn't come in. I was also in charge of petty cash in my office, which was my second paycheck. I supplemented my paycheck, and when I got paid, I paid petty cash back. They got paid before anything else got paid so that I could have it. And I started to borrow money from co-workers, and I'm having a little trouble. You know, the electric bill would come in, and I would get a resentment. Because I said, gee, they already have me with $1. Why are they bothering me? It's a joke. Can you hear how twisted the thinking is? It's just a little off. And every once in a while, I would like kind of straighten up my act a little bit. I forgot to tell you, I took a hostage. That means I got married. I married this guy when my son was about 10. The father wasn't in the picture. I married this guy, this really innocent, sweet, nice guy. He didn't know. And that didn't last long. And so I told him one day, I said, you know, if you really stay in this marriage, I'm going to hurt you. So we went to the divorce lawyers after 2 years holding hands and both crying, and I let him go. I don't know where that moment of sanity came from, but I think I would have destroyed that man. You know. But he tried really hard. He was a good guy. So we won't go more into that story. Things started to get really hectic. My son, I had made a prayer. The one prayer I made to God early on was, and the only prayer was that if he would let me live long enough to see my son get to college, because I thought since my mother died young that I was going to die young. And I knew how awful it was to leave a child with no mother. So my prayer to God was, if you let me live long enough for my son to get to college, you can take me after that. So my son graduated at 17. When he was 17, I was 33, which was the age my mother died. And I said, okay, my job is over. And also that year, I found a lump in my dress. So I basically laid on the floor and waited to die, literally. Except it didn't happen. So here's the problem. I didn't have a plan for after that. I had no vision of myself as an older woman. I had no vision of myself, like, you know, being involved with my son, like, beyond college or anything like that. It was just fun. And my drinking got worse, and I picked up some other things along the way. And one night, I crawled into my son's room, and I robbed my son. And I knew that it was wrong, and I was filled with shame, guilt, and remorse while I did it. And it was one of those never things. You know, we have a lot of things we're never going to do, and that was one. You couldn't mess with my son prior to that. And on this night, I became the enemy. And the next morning, you know, my son was like 6'3". The next morning, I had to face this my son. And I said to him, it's not the only time I said it was, I think I have a problem, and I think you have to pack up all your stuff and go with your grandpa. Now, my father and I were estranged. I hadn't spoken to my father in, I don't know how long. I was very angry at him. And I didn't call him and ask his permission or explain any circumstances. My son showed up on his doorstep. And, you know, so once my son was gone, all bets were off. Any semblance of me trying to keep it together, and I do mean semblance, because it had been unraveling for a while. But I tried to keep the roof over his head. I tried to see what he ate. I remember sitting down doing the budget. Here's how the budget used to work. You know, mortgage, car note, gas, electric, food, etc. And at the bottom of that list would be entertainment. Well, entertainment moved up the list until entertainment became the list. And how I would see my son as I would come in, this is at the end, and I would throw like $10 on the table and send them to Burger King. That was it. That is food, and you do with that what you will. I couldn't do it anymore, and I knew I couldn't do it, and that's why I sent him away. So once he left, all bets were off. My house became this place of insanity. And I stopped paying rent. I lived in a two-family house, and my landlord lived next door, the person who owned the house, and I was renting. And I used to pay my rent by putting in the money in an envelope and sliding it underneath her door. So then one day I got the bright idea to see if the money was still there. So I got a hanger, and I peeked under the door, and I saw the envelope, and I pulled it back out. So now I think he said, well, she should have got it while it was there. So it was just really insane. And so now I started moving. So I went from a five-room apartment to a four-room apartment. I put things in storage. I put clothes in the cleaners. But I'm not going back to pay the bill. I'm not going back to get them. I went from four rooms to three rooms to two rooms until one day, in February of 1990, I wound up homeless on the street. And all my possessions from 30-something years of life now fit into a green plastic garbage bag. And I slept on the train that first night, which was a very scary thing to do. And some other homeless people, by the time I tell you, my dad had passed away. And, you know, I'm homeless in the community that I have was born in and lived in all my life. So you might say, well, why didn't you go to your aunt or whatever? Well, here's why. Because they didn't have liked the way I was living. And if I'm robbing my son, your stuff doesn't even matter. So there was a part of me that knew that if I went there, it was going to involve me not drinking anymore, and I was not interested. You haven't heard detox or rehab in my story, because that's only for people who are trying to stop. I couldn't imagine life without a drink. What would I do with all that stuff that I was feeling, all that pain? I had nothing for that. So I'm homeless. And other homeless people are now telling me how to live homeless. So it's a nice little community out there. They said if you keep your coffee cut from the day before, McDonald's will give you free coffee. And then we have this place called Dunkin' Donuts. And if you go there about 5:30 in the morning, you can get donuts from the night before out of the garbage can. I'm thinking this is a good way to live. And this is how I'm living. The career is gone. The home is gone. The son is gone. I have no identification. I'm sleeping in the hospital waiting room now, the emergency room. Some other homeless people said that if I went there and I didn't make noise and I didn't make a mess, the guard would let me stay. So this is how I'm living. I'm living like an animal. I'm not washing. I'm just drinking. And I'm just basically waiting to die. So I would probably still be out there today, except that I met this other alcoholic, a guy. And I don't know why, but he took a liking to me. And he drank with me one night, and then he said, boy, you are really sick. And he said, would you come with me to a meeting? He had already been making meetings, not sober yet, but he had been making meetings. And now he wants to take me to a meeting, saving short, because if you got between you and a drink, you had a problem on your hands. But he came back the next night, and he asked me to go with him to these meetings tonight. I went. I don't know what was different one night to the next night. So now I make meetings, and I like the meetings right off the bat, because you people solve a couple of problems. I say you people because, AA people. Because they had cigarettes, coffee, and cookies. This eliminated some problems that I was having. Exactly, you know. And I'm going to the meetings, and here is my assessment of everyone in the meeting. Everybody is stupid. Look at these stupid people. I'm homeless, but you people are stupid. That's what I'm thinking. And I would go to the meeting. They said, come early, stay late. I was at the meeting 5 minutes after the guy with the keys showed up. I was there. So where else am I going? So I showed up at meetings early. I had set up, I made coffee, I put the literature out, and I got phone numbers. You know, I took most of the suggestions, not the ones I didn't think made sense. So I found out that thinking about suggestions doesn't work. Because I couldn't understand the suggestion. They said, get the phone numbers and call me before you drink. What? I'm at my house, you're at your house, I want to drink, how are you going to stop me? This is how I thought about this suggestion. So I had 200 phone numbers, but I wouldn't tell you till after I drank, because I like talking on the phone when I'm drunk. And at every meeting I went to, they gave me this how it works thing to read, which I thought was because I'm very intelligent. I understood all the big words, you know, and I was very articulate. No clue. And I'm making three meetings a day. I'm making a meeting at 1 o'clock, of which I would drink before and after. And then I would come back in the evening and make a double header and drink before. Sometimes I would go in the bathroom and drink, because you people are stupid, you're not going to know what's going on. And so I got a sponsor. They said men with the men, women with the women. So I got a male sponsor, of course. And because words don't apply to me. I'm not doing exactly what you say because I know better. So I got the sponsor, and he says, call me before you drink and get my permission, because I've been making meetings for like a year. I don't have any time at all. I'm standing at the door. He says, I want you to do service. Stand at the door and greet the people when they come in. I like this job. So I'm greeting people. I introduce them to people with time. I show them where the coffee is and where the restrooms are. And that person that I met at the door, a week later, has a week. I have 2 days. And 30 days later, that person I met at the door has 30 days. I have 3 days. A year later, that person was celebrating their first anniversary. I have a week. And I began to wonder, how is it that this super person now is driving to the meeting in a car? You know, I got a new job, and now I'm living in some lady's attic, and I'm every week now on the verge of being homeless again. You know, people would help me. I don't know why they did it. I smelled, I would rob you, and people kept saying, Linda, come let me help you, by the grace of God. You know, so people were helping me, and I was clueless. But I did see a guy that I used to drink with came in. One of those people I met at the door was a guy I grew up with, and I knew he was really bad. And he got sober. And I was like, But I didn't understand, okay, it's one thing to put the plug in the jug, it's another thing to live without a drink. And he was talking about some steps, and I didn't even know what the shades were. The shades were in front of me every day. I had no clue. They keep talking about shades. What shades? I just didn't get so many things. So anyway, I have about 28 days this particular time, and I had $20 that I got from somebody in the meeting, and I made three meetings, and I went home. It was like 10:30 at night, and the disease said, let's go, get one, time to go. And I hopped up like the faithful soldier I am. Except at this time, I heard my sponsor's voice say, call me before you drink. Okay, I'll tell you. But it's not a call. Hi, this is Linda, and this is how I'm talking, really, really fast. Hi, this is Linda. I have $20. I want to drink you, so call you. And I was going to go, bye. And then he started talking, and he said the serenity prayer together, and I don't know what else he said, but he said, well, Linda, do you still want to drink? And I kind of felt around inside, and the feeling to drink had left. Pissed me off. So that night, I called that man like 5 or 6 times. I called him at 2 o'clock. I called him at 4 o'clock, because this disease, one little serenity prayer is not going to knock that out. All night long, I kept wanting to go drink, and I kept picking up the phone, because I figured maybe by the fifth time, he's going to say, okay, go. That's not what happened. When the morning came, I had not left the house, and I still had $20 in my pocket. And I promise you, that had never happened before, where I had a strong desire to drink, and a teeny, little desire to let somebody help me, or to try it. That was September 11th, 1991. So I'm coming up on 17 years without a drink.
But in how it works, it talks about our adventures before and after. So the story gets more interesting. So now I'm not drinking. And I'm sitting up front, right where this guy is sitting, right in front of the speaker. I've been sitting in the same seat for 18 years. 16 has been sitting, 16 in a little bit. But I'm filled now with all that grief and anger and remorse and now shame and degradation and guilt on top of all of that stuff. And I've lost a career. I've wasted 8 or 9 years of my life. And I'm like, okay, now what? So every meeting I raise my hand and I'm begging. Hi, I'm Linda, I need a job. Hi, I'm Linda, I feel like crap. Hi, I'm Linda, I want a drink. Every day I'm whining and moaning and feeling sorry for myself. And they say, keep coming. Don't drink and keep coming. Is that all you got? And I want to peel my skin off. I'm so uncomfortable, restless, irritable, and discontent. And a drink is, looking like a good idea, because if this is all you got, don't drink, and I feel like crap, this is not going to work indefinitely. So my sponsor says, well, now you got to do some other work. Work? Work? I don't want to do any work. He says, you have to change the person you brought in here, or that person will take you back out. Change? What's wrong with me? Yeah. I found out that I had character defects. Who knew? Self-centered to the extreme. It's all about me. So my sponsor guided me through the 12 steps, you know. All right, so I admit I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is a wreck. I got that unmanageable part. Now we got to get to this come to believe part. See, I told you I have a problem with that God thing because he took my money. Well, he's in charge, Linda. You're going to need a power greater than yourself because you, in charge, let's just kind of look where that ended you up. Okay. So I kind of got with that. Okay, so now turn your will and life over to the care of this God. And he says, look, here's the wonderful thing. You decide you don't like how that's going, you can always go back to the crazy days. That's an option. That's what I say. I like that. I like that I have this option. Now you have to take a serious and thorough moral inventory. Oh my God. You mean I have to go back and look at all that crap? I have to look at the stuff I did, and then I have to look at the stuff you did to me. Because I made two lists. And I wrote it all down, and now I have to tell it to somebody. I have to tell secrets that were going to go to the grave with me, that I was so ashamed of. But I told them, and I waited to see if my sponsor was going to fall off the chair, because he never heard any stuff like this before, and I was met with such love and such acceptance and non-judgment. So then when I saw how that was going, I got rid of it all. I joked about that even I had forgot about. Because I knew I wasn't going to be able to sit in those chairs with that stuff. You know, then I had to give those things to God, ask for forgiveness, write a list, and begin the process of cleaning up the records of my past. So let me tell you, institutions, employers, neighbors, family, relationship, finances, every aspect of a life that could be wrecked was wrecked. I literally started with nothing in these rooms, and I'm grateful that God stripped away all those things that got between me and him. Everything was a distraction. So he cleared all of that away. So now we start with nothing. One of the earliest gifts of recovery I got was gratitude. Because I told you, I was sitting in these rooms whining every day about what I didn't have. And I said, well, see, how come there's people that worked on the same job for 27 years and still have the house and fact did more while drinking? And I had to lose everything. He said, well, you wouldn't stop while you had anything left. He had these answers for things. He said, you had that stuff, and you kept drinking. So if you still got stuff, stop now. And then I remember trying to figure out, how do you stop drinking? That was a big question to me. So this old timer was in the meeting one day, and he said, But if you're sitting here now and you're not drinking, you're already stopped. The trick is to let us show you how to stay stopped. So back to the steps. So now we got a nice step of making amends and cleaning up the records of the past, and I couldn't do that stuff overnight because I'm just starting to work again, and it was a process that I became willing to do that. And then in that 10th step, you start the maintenance, you know, where I'm taking my inventory on a regular basis and looking at the wrong, not if I am wrong, when I am wrong, and promptly admitting it. So I had a job in early recovery that every day I had to apologize to somebody. I mean, every day I was working with somebody's office like, I'm sorry. Because every day I brought me an alcoholism to the job. And I was a nasty, arrogant lady. and then I got tired of apologizing all the time. I got sick of it. So that meant that my behavior had to change. And, you know, prayer and meditation. So I'm praying. I have to tell you, I'm praying, and I'm still not really feeling connected to much, a little bit, because I'm not drinking. So something is going on there that I couldn't do. And I acknowledge and accept it, that there is some power that was helping me do this. But I'm not 100% sure. I'm kind of like, at this point, I'm agnostic. I don't go to church. I still don't go to church. But I have a faith in God. Any God that could take me out the gutter, dust me off, and set me on this journey, it's got to be working with something. And then the most wonderful gift is giving this back, carrying the message to other alcoholics. Strenuous work with alcoholics is how we stay sober today. And I like the newcomer coming in who's just like me. Let him come in with nothing. Oh, I love those times. I like the ones that are still drinking. Ooh. Because there's nothing they could tell me that I haven't already been through, and I don't think about it. So as Leslie was saying, you know, as a result of this program, you know, my family, I have three grandsons who have never seen me drunk. The relationship with my son, you know, one day my son said to me, you know, Mom, it's always been about you. And my poor son is an only child. And he's saying, it's always been about me. So lately, I am making amends to my grandson. And it's a lot different than sitting down and cooking and coloring. And I've had to learn how to make those amends by talking to other people who have grown children in recovery, you know, and coming to meetings like this and healing some of the damage. And I'll tell you one thing my son said to me. He said, and he waited until I had 15 years to tell me this. I had asked him all along, you know, I had explained a little bit about alcoholism and some of the things that happened to me, but not in great detail. And one day, I was sitting with him and his wife, and he started crying. I mean, gut-wrenching, sobbing. And he came and laid in my arms. And I just received it. I didn't extend. I just held him while all this pain came out. I didn't know exactly what was going on, but I knew that it was cleansing for him. And he started talking about some things. He started talking about how those nights when I put him to bed and thought he would sleep, that he never went to sleep until I came home. And he had to get up and go to school. And I thought, I waited for him to be breathing evenly and then I'm out the door. He said, "My, he never went to sleep until he came back." Oh. And he told me other things like that. And I said, "Well, why haven't you told me this before?" He said, "I couldn't tell you until I thought you weren't going to drink about it." So he waited 15 years. So I was able to receive, that was a gift, because I think it allowed him to begin to heal in some ways. And then he asked me if there was a place he could go for help. And I said, "You know, they have a place called Al-Anon." And I got him some information. I don't know if he's gone yet or not, but at least he knows there's a place he can go where there are people just like him who have grown up in homes with crazy people. I went back to college. I never finished college while I was in there in my 20s because I got to the point where I thought I was smarter than the professor. But I went back to college at 43, and I graduated magna cum laude, and then at 48, I went to law school. And I share that because there are people who are like 29 and 35 and 20 who think it's too late. So I went to work, I graduated at 52, I've taken the bar a couple of times, I haven't passed it, I don't think I'm taking it anymore. But I'm okay with having a JD. And I went to law school for a couple of reasons. I didn't want to practice law, but I wanted a legal education. But I also went to raise my own self up, to raise my self-esteem. You raise your self-esteem by doing esteemable things. You know, so I went to school. I didn't think I still had two brain cells clicking together at the same time. And I went to see if that was happening also. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that I've gone through in this journey, I have not done alone. Not one thing have I done alone. When I was 5 years sober, I lived in a little basement apartment and the sewer was backed up and I lost everything that I had gained in my first 5 years of recovery and I had to start all over again. And I closed the door on my apartment as I watched my refrigerator floating on its side, and I went into a meeting like this. I walked in the door of the meeting with my hands up, sharing that I needed help. You know, and that I was just overwhelmed and how unfair this was, but, you know, I went through that, AA people came and helped me clean up, and I started all over again. And then a couple years after that, I woke up one morning and I couldn't walk. And I had developed degenerative muscle disease. And, you know, I was like laying there saying, okay, God, like, how is this fair? But it's not about fair. And actually, during that time that I was sick, I felt the presence of God in my life unlike I had felt at any other time. And the family of AA rallied around, and they carried me to meetings and laid me on the back of the table because I wanted to make meetings. And I got better, you know. I met a doctor who figured out I had this rare autoimmune disease and treated it, and I went back to work, and I went back to school, and, you know, I mean, God believes in miracles. I am a miracle. Everyone that comes and gets one day without a drink, because I can't promise you I'm going to be sober next week. I don't drink one day at a time. I'm responsible for what I do for my recovery today. And here's what I do. I get up in the morning and I thank God for waking me up, which I used to take for granted, and now I know is a gift. I ask Him to help me not pick up today. And I ask Him, what is His will for me today, and how can I be of service? And at the end of the day, I thank Him. And thank you for letting me share.